Thank you. I want to begin first by expressing my sincere gratitude to the organization of this most important, the organizers of this most important conference or symposium, and secondly, for inviting me to be a part of these distinguished people here in the country that has said no to U.S. imperialism. Secondly, I am delighted that the symposium is centered around the 65th birthday of Malcolm and the 25th anniversary of his inglorious assassination. Apart from my mother, no other person has helped to shape my thinking and to turn me on to the books and the people that the white educational system, like the Roman Catholic seminaries, hide and are ignorant of and or don't want to know, than the years of personal interrelationship with Malcolm X in Harlem. While he would never describe himself as such, he was a master of liberation theology. The topic that is in the symposium is precisely what I'm going to try to stick to, and being a priest, I probably am even less disciplined than the layman, but I will try to do so within the frame, the time frame.
Lawrence Lucas of the Church of the Resurrection Church of New York and member of December 12th. Now I give the floor to Reverend Lawrence Lucas, and I hope that he will be able to be more disciplined than Dr. Treto, that had talked more than 15 minutes.
Thank you. I want to begin first by expressing my sincere gratitude to the organization of this most important, the organizers of this most important conference or symposium, and secondly, for inviting me to be a part of these distinguished people here in the country that has said no to U.S. imperialism. Secondly, I am delighted that the symposium is centered around the 65th birthday of Malcolm and the 25th anniversary of his inglorious assassination. Apart from my mother, no other person has helped to shape my thinking and to turn me on to the books and the people that the white educational system, like the Roman Catholic seminaries, hide and are ignorant of and or don't want to know, than the years of personal interrelationship with Malcolm X in Harlem. While he would never describe himself as such, he was a master of liberation theology. The topic that is in the symposium is precisely what I'm going to try to stick to, and being a priest, I probably am even less disciplined than the layman, but I will try to do so within the frame, the time framework that has been allotted. My procedure will be to give a brief but hopefully succinct conceptualization of what I mean by liberation theology, and then some of these fundamental principles and beliefs to go into rather briefly, and from there to look at the ideology and its consequent norms of conduct embodied in the ideology that was held forth, and then to reach certain conclusions as the consequence of the above procedure. By theology, I mean the study, the understanding, and experience and appreciation of God, of man's relationship to God, of human interrelationships, and of human relationships with the rest of the creation precisely because of and dependent upon man's relationship with God. Liberation is seen in the context of freeing or releasing from something or someone, but not in a vacuum, but geared towards someone or something. And putting those two ideas together, liberation theology is understood as a freeing of oneself, a people, or a nation for the purpose of being, doing, and becoming what God wants one or the people or the nation to be and to be about. It is releasing or breaking whatever bonds or chains that prevent the achievement of one's reason for being. It is theology alive, gleaned from, and explied and applied to the experience of an oppressed people. All right. Because I come from a Roman Catholic theological and biblical perspective, I must quickly, lest we be confused, make a distinction between those claiming or professing to be Christians or Roman Catholics and some fundamental beliefs and principles of Christianity or Roman Catholicism. Unfortunately, history has demonstrated that it's been rare indeed, if ever, that a sizable minority of Christians or Catholics ever knew, much less internalized, and made choices or acted upon these principles and beliefs. And so, therefore, I must make that distinction. While the historian can examine it in terms of those who profess to be, I think, from a theological perspective, you have to make the distinction between those who profess and the fundamental teachings, just as one would certainly be led down the primrose path if they took their understanding of democracy from the thinking, the choosing, and the behavior, for example, of the vast majority of the citizens of the United States of America. And the relationship between the two would be at best purely coincidental. Now, some of these fundamental principles and beliefs are the following. The basis of this, of course, is the African theologian who wrote the book of Genesis, and later on we will deal with the so-called Ten Commandments. One principle that is very clear, that creation is ultimately, and the big word here is ultimately, the work of an all-wise, all-powerful, all-loving, intelligent being, generally in English referred to as God. Number two, the human being is made unique and special in the English translation of the biblical language in the image of God, meaning, however, that the human being is endowed with two gifts that set the human being apart, the gifts of mind, intelligence, ability to know, to appreciate, and to reason, and what we call will, namely the ability to make choices. The third point is that creation belongs to God, life more so, and human life mostly so. There is a priority in creation between the inanimate world, the living world, and in the living world, between the intelligent and choosing living world. A fourth point, God offered by way of choice to the human being a unique relationship with God that was to govern human interrelationships and relationships with the rest of creation, over which God gave the human being dominion, meaning ownership and control. And that relationship is described in, among many ways in the scriptures, as a father-child-children-family relationship. A fifth point, human beings rejected that offer, which led to dreadful consequences and the need of salvation or savior. Sixth point, these beliefs and principles were to be taught, understood, and experienced in the context of a people, a nation, a kahal, if you will, an ecclesia, and shared with others by word and example of that particular nation or people. The seventh point, the following understandings and consequent behavior should characterize this nation or people of God. This is what we see expressed in the so-called Ten Commandments, which were neither ten and were not rules or laws or regulations, as has been popularly misconceived. Among them, God must be respected and given his rights and be the ultimate basis of our thinking, our decisions and actions. Not the state, not money, not the statues, not race, not the country, etc., etc. Second point, because the universe and its resources, life and above all human life belongs to God, the nation does not and doesn't allow the resources and human beings to be abused and reduced to the level of enriching the few. That was the whole business of the Sabbath rest, which many folks have reduced to the level of running into a building, making some noise, shouting, tapping, and clapping, and then leaving no different than when you entered. Actually, the Sabbath or Saturday was chosen because of its traditional connection with the Exodus, and so it was chosen the Saturday before Jesus. In the Christian community, that day was Sunday, but it was primarily a day of freedom from the demands of the marketplace, of freedom of not only the land, but above all the animals, and most importantly, the human being, from being reduced simply to a tool of the enrichment of a few. In this nation of God, adult children, another point, have the responsibility of caring for their aging parents, And a God society has a special responsibility towards the aged, the disabled, the widows, and the orphans who were particularly the victims of oppression at that time. This is what generally is looked upon as a so-called fourth, which folks usually interpret in terms of telling children to behave, obey, and listen to your parents, which, of course, this had nothing to do with children-adult relationship, but primarily adult-adult relationship. There's another point. In a nation of God, no one has a right to injure or harm his own life or to take another's life, particularly out of revenge or through irresponsibility, since life belongs to God. As a corollary, there is a responsibility, not merely a right, but a responsibility to defend one's life and one's neighbor's life against any unjust aggression. Another point, in the nation of God, marriage and family life are seen as the nucleus of nation building. Hence, anything or anybody that hinders, obstructs, or destroys family life and marriage must be confronted and eliminated by a nation of God. Point F, if you will, in a nation, no one has a right, nor could you tolerate the theft of another man's freedom or labor for profit or any other purpose. The business of you shall not steal, contrary to popular misinterpretation, had nothing to do with taking somebody else's goods primarily, but the kidnapping, the enslaving, the kidnapping of another human being's freedom and labor for the purpose of enriching the few. Obviously, it is the foundation on which the United States and all imperialistic nations are based. Another point, in the nation, I use the term criminal justice system only because it is a term that is used in the States, but whatever you want to call it, but the criminal justice system, and this is what the bearing false witness is directly related to, is to be a vehicle of God's justice. Never can it be a tool for class, race, or economic oppression. I might add and aside that in the United States of America, then the whole criminal justice system is directly contrary to the biblical tradition. In a nation of God, it is to be considered wrong or unacceptable to violate any of the above, not only to violate, but to choose or want to do so. This is generally what the so-called 9 and 10 is all about. Of course, these basic ideas, principles, were expanded upon and developed, most particularly, at least from the Christian perspective, by Jesus, who was also given the name the Anointed One, or the Christ, or the Messiah. This ideology, then, and its consequent norms of conduct, embodies positions held and popularized by Malcolm X, whatever his source or road of arriving at them were. To list a few, nation or people building is a must and a first. It was a primary concern of Malcolm X that our first endeavor must be our own building of a nation, building of a people. Included in this notion of nation building or people building is the right and responsibility, self-knowledge, self-identification, self-determination, and its context then, or relationship with Afrocentrism. The goal of the nation as liberation rather than integration was a principal position, not the first, a development of, a popularization of, but something that had been said by many thinkers before him, where in a group of people looking primarily for integration on their oppressor's term with their oppressor for their oppressor's benefit, there was fundamental position of Malcolm that our goal has got to be liberation from control, ownership, and domination rather than integration. The third point, the context of the struggle was seen as a human rights context rather than a civil rights context. Namely, that when you put it in the context of civil rights, you are putting your whole reason for being and the quality of your being in the hands of the very society that has oppressed you all your life. Malcolm put it in the context of the rights that we have as human beings from the religious perspective given to us by God, irrespective of what any particular society may feel or about it and may grant or not grant. It was totally relevant. For Malcolm, for example, it wasn't the Congress of the United States, it wasn't the Supreme Court, it wasn't the institution so-called of law and order, more properly of lawlessness and disorder, but it was the Creator, by the very fact that you were a human being, who gave you these rights of self-knowledge, self-identification, self-determination, and self-defense, wherever that became necessary. And the question of capitalism versus communism versus socialism, if you want. From the biblical perspective, because the bottom line is justice or righteousness, understood in the sense of being right with God and as a consequence being right with your fellow man and the rest of creation, that was justice was more important than any ism. The question must always be, which economic, social, political systems at any or a given time is better fostering justice from that particular point of view? It is very interesting that particularly those who claim Christianity so unused to their own documents that if you were to examine the Acts of the Apostles, one of the books of the collection called the Bible, in which the author expresses how the first Jerusalem community, after the resurrection of Jesus, if you will, believed they could best carry out the mandate, the ideology, and the purpose of life, they chose a socialist communist society, where capitalism or the opportunity of a few to grab everything at the expense of the many, but rather a society in which everything was owned and people receive and dealt with according to need, rather of the majority, rather than according to the greed of the few. And so it